You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Joe Biden has taken his first major steps to address gun violence, and we want to know how have your life experiences affected the way you see guns and the debate around them today. Now, the FDA and CDC have recommended that states temporarily stop giving the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine after six people developed a rare blood clotting disease. The Wisconsin Health Department has followed the federal government's advice and will pause giving those shots until a federal review of the vaccine determines its safety. Also, Michigan is seeing a big spike in COVID cases. We're looking at why our neighbor state is seeing another wave of COVID and whether Wisconsin might be in store for a surge as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Were you scheduled to get one of these Johnson & Johnson shots? How do you feel now that you won't be able to, at least for now? Would you still want to get it if you were able to? And with rising numbers in Michigan and elsewhere, are you worried that people are not taking safety precautions for COVID? Call it at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ajay Sethi is Associate Professor of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Ajay, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about this Johnson & Johnson vaccine news. It's being described as an abundance of caution of six people with this rare blood clot issue. Lots and lots of people have had this vaccine, though. Can you talk about this decision to put this temporary pause on that particular vaccine?
Yeah, it was done, as you said, out of an abundance of caution. Six women were developing these blood clots, and it was within a week or two after receiving the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And as you know, when the AstraZeneca vaccine that's used widely in Europe, there were also cases of these blood clots occurring in people, exceptionally rare, but they also paused vaccination there. And I think that might have also led the CDC to do that, to make a proper review of the cases and to see if they have something in common, if something can be uncovered, and if a link can be made. And it may not be, but we'll find out soon.
Well, I'll talk personally here. I was scheduled to get that very vaccine in a couple of days. And me looking at the risks, I would have still gone ahead and done it, having heard this information, looking at the rarity of these cases, the benefits of the vaccine. At the same time, I feel a little reassured that that any possible side effect, serious side effect that hadn't been in there in the testing is being taken really seriously by somebody and that there's this sort of transparency. Can you talk about that balancing act on a decision like this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you don't want there to be rumors of a vaccine side effect that, you know, isn't true. And the best way to address that is to stay ahead of the narrative. And that's what the CDC is doing, is to do a proper investigation to find out if these six cases, you know, in some way have some commonality between them that can explain why these clots occurred. It's exceptionally rare. I mean, six cases out of 6.8 million people who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And that kind of rate is similar to the rate that people experience blood clots in the community in general without vaccination. But nevertheless, it's important to investigate that and see if there's a possible link. And we'll find out.
And looking at how this is going to impact wider vaccination efforts, we've been ramping up as a nation, as a state, pretty quickly with our mix of three different vaccines. How big a problem is it for that ramp up if one of these is off the table for, I don't know, a few days or a week?
Well, you know, we were entering a period, or we are going to be entering a period, where we were going to see a dip in the available vaccines made by Johnson & Johnson. So because of manufacturing issues, everybody was anticipating this. And the Biden administration stated that there's plenty of Moderna and Pfizer vaccines available to sort of continue the momentum that the country has had for vaccination at 3 million a day. So it shouldn't have an impact. If anything, it's a good thing that this investigation will take place and we can see what's going on.
We're talking to UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi about some of the latest COVID-19 news, the news today of a pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, and then the news we originally called you about, Ajay, about Some states, including our neighbors in Michigan, seeing big increases in their COVID-19 positive test numbers, hospitalizations, and weathering. Is it going to happen next year in Wisconsin? What are you looking at when you see these numbers from states like Michigan?
Yeah, I mean, what's happening in Michigan is quite alarming. The surge in cases is reaching the peak that they had, that a lot of states had back in November. We're also seeing a rise in hospitalizations that's following that as expected, particularly among younger individuals because they're less likely to be vaccinated. And deaths are starting to creep up as well. And so they are sort of leading the surge in the United States. Just a handful of states are doing that. And Michigan is right there in front.
And part of the story here is this variant that looks like maybe now the dominant variant of COVID-19 in the United States. This is the B117, I think. Can you talk about this variant and why it's accelerating our problems right now?
Yeah, so it's called B117, so that's right, or also the UK variant. And it's been in the United States for a little while. It's more infectious than sort of your garden variety coronaviruses. And because it's more infectious, it more efficiently spreads from one person to the other. And as a result, it's sort of becoming the dominant strain in the U.S., particularly in the states that are now seeing these surges. And basically every state has this B117 variant. So we should all be concerned about having a surge as a result.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Kelsey is with us in Madison. Kelsey, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm on multiple medications, both for birth control and also for rheumatoid arthritis. And coincidentally, almost all of those medications have a much higher risk for blood clotting. So I guess I'm wondering why the FDA would shut down vaccine, administration over a much lower risk in blood clotting. Is that because the studies didn't disclose that information, didn't find it? Or is it just because all of the public anxiety over vaccine safety lately?
Kelsey, thanks for that call. And I've seen that Ajay said that exact same point being made, that there are medications regularly used on the market now that raise maybe even higher risks of blood clotting. Why does the vaccine get this different treatment?
Well, again, we want to make sure that the vaccine is safe for everybody. And if there is an opportunity to recommend a different vaccine for someone, who has a higher risk for these clots, then you'd want to be able to study that. And that's important. The pause also allows for healthcare professionals around the country to recognize also that if they happen to have one of these exceptionally rare cases where a patient develops these clots, to not treat with blood thinners or heparin, because in the case of these six women, one of them had died and one is in, I believe, in critical care because they had received heparin. And that's something you don't want to do for this kind of clot. And so this pause is also a chance to just educate healthcare providers across the country as to how to handle these exceptionally rare cases. But I agree, they are rare, and other medications, including birth control, can also cause clotting as well.
Kelsey, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Steve joins us next in New Glarus. Steve, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Steve?
Well, I just wanted to let you know I was getting into my vehicle this morning on my way to go to the Madison VA hospital. I was scheduled to get a shot for the virus, and as I got into my vehicle, I got a phone call from the VA nurse at the hospital telling me that they're no longer giving the shots at the Veterans Hospital. They have some questions about people who are having problems with blood clots from getting the shot. And so I didn't question that. I was glad that somebody called to let me know that it could be dangerous.
Steve, thanks for the call. I'm sorry about that roller coaster. Sounds like he was scheduled to get that Johnson & Johnson shot. Ajay, I'm glad they saved him the ride. But the message to take home here isn't necessarily that this shot is particularly dangerous. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's still considered exceptionally safe. It's just that when you have a situation related to a vaccine or any kind of product that's being used widely. If there is going to be some side effect that's not been previously documented, you want to do the appropriate review so that we understand if there needs to be recommendations made moving forward. Because it's exceptionally rare, I imagine that if there is indeed a link, we'll probably resume using the vaccine, but be able to tell the story of why some people may experience these clots that are, you know, one in several million.
Steve, thanks for calling in and good luck to you getting maybe one of the other ones as soon as possible. We are talking to Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest COVID-19 news, including surges in Michigan and other states when it comes to the numbers, and this Johnson & Johnson vaccine news, a temporary pause while they review some cases, of, as we heard, very rare of blood clots. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you worry that people are not taking precautions now, maybe the way they once were with masks, with being careful about distancing? Have you been vaccinated yet yourself? Are you looking forward to it? Are you one of the people who, like Steve and like me, who had that appointment canceled this week? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk about the latest COVID news with UW-Madison epidemiologist Ajay Sethi. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hearing from relatives in states like Michigan, like mine, about rising case numbers? Are you worried that people aren't taking this seriously? Do you have questions about the vaccines, the news about the pause on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine? And did you have an appointment that turned to disappointment to get that Johnson & Johnson vaccine? Share your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Mike is with us in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Well, first of all, because you asked, I had it just before it was a thing. I've always tested negative, and I got both shots. Actually, the most dangerous thing you do is drive to the clinic. The question I got is, do you think that the lawyering profession is just salivating over the possibilities once this is finally over?
Oh, as far as liability, Ajay, is that something you follow, concerns about lawsuits related to the rare side effects from vaccines? I know for previous vaccines, there's been a compensation system on that off chance that people have reactions. I don't know if that's happening with the COVID vaccines.
No, there is that system to compensate individuals who experience adverse events. I'm not to say anything against lawyers, but, you know, I think there's always... people are always looking for an opportunity to provide that service. So I don't know about salivating, but sure.
Thanks for the call. We heard from Michelle, who emailed, "I'm very upset and think it's completely ridiculous that they've stopped the usage of the vaccine." She goes on, "I would absolutely still get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine if I could. It took me hours to get the appointment. Now I have to start all over." So a lot of people in this boat, Ajay, we've heard from a couple of them already. Do you worry that that's going to slow down the vaccination effort just as people like Michelle have to start from scratch to get their appointments?
It is inconvenient, certainly. If you had an appointment like yourself and others, you know, Steve earlier, you know, it's inconvenient to have that appointment canceled and to look for another appointment. But some vaccinators are able to provide a different vaccine. And I know that on our campus, that was the case for some people who had appointments today for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So the key thing is not to lose hope. This is a pause versus a shutdown of the vaccine. And the ACIP, the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, is meeting tomorrow with the CDC to discuss the safety data. And within a couple of days, we will know whether or not the vaccine will resume rollout or if it'll continue that pause. And so I think it's likely not going to be pulled off the market entirely.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Ajay Sethi, Associate Professor of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at some of the latest COVID-19 news. As you just heard, questions about the vaccines and what this pause for the Johnson & Johnson vaccine means. As we have this surge in cases in states like Michigan and some others, concerns about what's going on here in Wisconsin. I want to look at that a little more now. Ajay, I know public health officials, a lot of leaders really trying to get that public health message out there to not abandon our health safety measures right now. Don't give up those masks. Don't take those risky gatherings, especially for the unvaccinated. Can you talk about the message that people are trying to send as we try to get the vaccinations up and keep the cases down?
Yeah, that's right. I think what's happening in Michigan can certainly happen here in Wisconsin. We're doing really well in terms of immunizing relative to other states, but no state, including ours, has immunized enough to be able to prevent outbreaks. And so we are vulnerable. And if you have any kind of setting where a lot of unvaccinated people are together, and if one person has either any of the varieties of coronavirus, but particularly this B.1.1.7 variant that's more infectious, we can expect transmission and clusters, and the state certainly is investigating lots of clusters around, you know, we've been seeing this sort of increase for the last couple of weeks, and I think we're all on the edge of our seats to see if we can experience a surge too, and hopefully not.
We heard from Saul via email asking about the new variant becoming more virulent to young people. Saul writes, I heard that half of hospitalized COVID victims in Brazil, for example, are under the age of 40. Is that true? If so, that's not good news with the variant now established in the U.S. So this new variant, we know more transmissible. Does it seem more dangerous to the individual who gets it, especially as Saul is saying, to that person under 40?
So I'll say in Brazil, there's the P1 variant.
That is the one that Saul had asked about, by mistake. Yeah,
and so P1 is in the United States, but it's not dominating like the B.1.1.7 is. And the B.1.1.7, there was studies published just on Monday in The Lancet, showing that that this virus is not more deadly. It is more infectious, but not more virulent. There was an earlier report out of the UK that implicated that. It was unclear. These studies can be very difficult to rule out other factors that drive any of these observations, but the study published on Monday seems to show that this is not a virus that's more deadly. And other studies are showing that the vaccines work very well against them.
And we also heard from Jacob in Madison, who couldn't stay on the line, but was asking, is there an association between the recent rise in cases and spring break? Ajay, are we able to pinpoint the rise in numbers to any particular kinds of reopenings or events like a spring break or things like that?
I mean, travel is always associated with the spread of this virus around the country. And so spring break and other forms of travel are associated with cases that are spreading in Wisconsin. It's not necessarily the only reason. There are clusters that are being investigated in schools and other settings, youth sports, for example, where you have a lot of unvaccinated people, in this case, children, who gather.
Let's go back to our callers now. Jamie is with us in Springfield Corners. Jamie, hi.
Hello. I got my first dose of the vaccine just yesterday, and one of the things that did kind of surprise me, at least it kind of frightened me, was that there are these nanoparticle lipids that are added to the doses. And I understand their what their purpose is, to be able to allow the messenger RNA to be able to go into the cells easier. But my question is, what types of side effects have we seen with these nanoparticles? And what types of possible side effects could we see?
Thanks for the call. Ajay, would that be just in the general side effect profile we've seen of the vaccine as a whole, or is there something in particular about these lipid nanoparticles our caller's talking about?
Yeah, that's right. They're just basically tiny lipids, little fat droplets that allow for the RNA to be packaged. By putting it inside sort of a nanolipid particle, you're giving a person a delivery system that the body won't develop an immune response to. So it kind of does it under a cloak, if you will. to deliver the RNA to cells in the muscle. And as far as I know, the vaccine has been exceptionally safe. All of them have so far. And so there should not be any reactions to that.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Ajay, right now, we've got plenty of demand for the supply for the vaccines that are out there. But there's concern at some point that, we're going to have a big supply and now trying to reach the people who are, for whatever reason, reluctant to get the vaccines. What kind of public health efforts do you see out there and do you see being needed to reach out to people who are hesitant right now?
Yeah, public health, community groups, lots of different agencies are getting into neighborhoods to talk to people about the vaccine, the benefits of vaccination, and to answer questions and to allay any fears about the vaccine. Some people just also need some time to make that decision. And so if somebody was previously reluctant to get it and then later on did get it, that's a success. And so it's just maybe it does sometimes take time and have some conversations with people to make sure they understand what they're getting. And there's nothing wrong with anybody always wanting their questions answered before having any kind of medical intervention like a vaccine or a treatment.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Ajay, what are you watching for next in the progress of this disease and the vaccine effort against it?
Well, it is a race against the variants, as people say. I would say it's also a race against COVID fatigue. Everybody wants to return to normal. I'm hoping here in Wisconsin, we don't see a surge like we are seeing in Michigan and elsewhere. And the best way to do that is to mitigate.
Ajay, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob.
Ajay Sethi is Associate Professor of Population Health Sciences at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at the latest COVID-19 news. President Joe Biden has officially announced a series of executive actions aimed at addressing gun violence in the United States. Measures include restrictions on who can buy certain guns and tightened regulations on stabilizing braces for pistols. Biden ran for president on a gun control platform that activists praised as the strongest in history, but reforms won't come without a fight in an evenly divided Senate, and the National Rifle Association has said it's ready to fight any new federal gun control measures. People are divided on how they feel about guns. A Gallup poll in February showed that 56% of Americans are dissatisfied with current gun laws in the U.S. 42% are very or somewhat satisfied with current laws. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, not just about what you think about laws, but how you came to feel that way. Your experiences with guns over your lifetime that led to your thoughts now. What experiences or beliefs shape the way you feel about guns and who has the right to buy and own them? Did you grow up in a gun-owning family? Were you a victim of gun violence? When did you start feeling strongly about guns, for or against? Or do you have mixed feelings? What do you argue with yourself about? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Robert Spitzer is Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science at State University of New York at Cortland. He's the author of 5 books on gun policy, including the new 8th edition of The Politics of Gun Control. Bob, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be with you.
Well, in this new suite of executive actions from the president, some are aimed at violence prevention. Some are technical things related to guns. Let's start with that second part first. What kind of control measures do you see coming from the White House here?
Well, they're trying to do what they can by executive orders. And let me just say, it's important to point out that executive orders are legally binding, but they only apply to the executive branch and the behavior of executive branch agencies. So generally speaking, they don't necessarily have the reach of regular legislation passed by Congress, whereas, as you pointed out in your setup, President Biden is going to face a pretty tough time dealing with the evenly divided U.S. Senate. But in terms of the executive orders he's formulating, I would say that the one about ghost guns is really extremely important. In 2019, 10,000 ghost guns were recovered at crime scenes or in the hands of criminals. And as many of your listeners know, ghost guns refers to guns generally that are bought in parts and assembled by the person who buys them, but they have no identifying serial numbers on them. And that's the critical thing about them. They're not traceable for that reason. And it raises the question, of course, of namely why any honest person would want to have a gun with no serial numbers on it. And the only reason that one could think of is because they want to do something bad with the gun. And law enforcement all around the country has reported a dramatic increase in these weapons appearing at crime scenes. And since 2019, I've no doubt that, in this year we'll see far more than 10,000 ghost guns recovered at crime scenes. So this would be the point to try and stop the flow of those before they become an ever more massive problem. So that, I think, is a very important step that he wants to take. He's also proposed a couple of things that have received less attention. One is that they want to replicate a study that was last done 20 years ago on gun trafficking, because even now, the information that the government and researchers have about gun trafficking patterns is fairly incomplete. And it's extremely useful to know how guns are trafficked from the point of leaving a factory to the point at which something bad happens with them or to them or using them. And so purely as a matter of getting a better handle on gun trafficking patterns, that could be very important, as is this proposal of the Biden administration to establish a legal template for red flag laws. 20 states have adopted these so-called red flag laws, and these are laws that say if a person who owns guns exhibits immediate and dire behavior such that they may be suicidal or homicidal, a relative or the police can file a motion, have the guns temporarily removed, a judge examines the case to decide whether the person should get the guns back or not. And there have already been several studies of these laws in other states, because they've been around for a while, that showed that they've been pretty effective, especially in stemming suicides. So those are, all fairly important steps, I would say.
Then other executive actions aim to direct money to local violence prevention programs. Where do you see an effort like that as far as what we need to prevent gun violence?
Well, this is something that you would think absolutely everybody would be in favor of, and indeed it may well have bipartisan support, because this is an intervention kind of program. First, we've seen these programs in localities around the country, and they've been carried out unevenly. Some of them are well-funded, some of them not. Some localities have gone aggressively in this direction and others not. But they seem to be pretty effective in staving off violence to begin with, and especially gun violence. And so, preventing a violent encounter, especially if guns are involved, would be a really tremendously useful strategy, and one based on these kinds of programs in the past that has the potential of being very promising and effective, and they're putting a fair amount of money behind it. So that, I think, would be also a really significant step.
Talking to Robert Spitzer from the State University of New York at Cortland. He's the author of many books related to gun policy, including the new 8th edition of The Politics of Gun Control, looking at new executive actions from the Biden administration. Interested in hearing from you if you want to share your story of your relationship with firearms through your life and how you think that's affected your political views on them, whether they're on one side or another or mixed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And Bob, I want to get into some of that, the public opinion side of things and how we try to measure what leads people to think about guns in the way that they do. And that's a big part of the politics of gun control. What do we know about why we think what we do about guns and gun control?
Well, like many issues, it has a lot to do with your personal experiences and your personal background. And people who own guns and for whom gun ownership is meaningful, it's not just a rifle propped in a closet somewhere that never gets pulled out, but for people who care about the shooting sports, about gun ownership and use, they have that personal experience. And unfortunately, gun owners have been bombarded with a lot of negative messaging over the years about the prospect or the consequences of various gun regulations. People who hold those opinions most strongly also will act very much based on, and by any means in a political way, will act based on their beliefs on the gun issue. And that's what has made the kind of the gun rights movement a very powerful and influential movement in kind of the American interest group system. And most people do support stronger gun laws, and in fact, most gun measures find support among gun owners as well. But among those who don't own guns, they don't have that kind of personal experience. And while some Americans do have direct experience with, you know, violence in their lives, family members, things like that, we have to remember that despite the alarming news about mass shootings and other things, crime rates are low. Crime rates, including violent crimes, have been dropping in America for nearly 30 years. We have seen an uptick in the murder rate in the last couple of years, and that's obviously not a good thing. But America is really a pretty safe place, and that includes violent crimes, too, despite, you know, the headline-grabbing shootings and violent crimes that do occur. And in that context, the majority of Americans don't have the kind of deep personal connection to the gun issue, and so most Americans support stronger gun laws, but it's not something that the typical American has a real strong feeling about. And it's only when something terrible happens, like a mass shooting, for example, that people become indignant and really focus on the attention. But what happens is that as time goes by, attention tends to turn back to other issues that people are more likely to be thinking about. So you have a small but highly motivated minority that's kind of the gun rights community that's active on the issue and expresses themselves politically, which, of course, is, you know, part of the political process, versus the large but less motivated majority on this particular issue.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Stephen is with us in Waterford. Stephen, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Stephen?
Well, I just want to let you know that I'm a 73-year-old male that served 8 years in the Marine Corps during the Vietnam era, and I have had weapons or guns in my possession up until now, and I feel that they're necessary for me to continue, you know, protecting society if I need to, and I do have a concealed carry permit, which I think is valid, and I also think that there should be controls on who gets weapons or guns, but it's very difficult to determine and protect or prejudge who's going to maybe change their attitude towards society at any given moment. It's a hard one to do. I mean, gun control is hard to do because you don't see those individuals as being a threat to society until it's over with.
Stephen, thanks a lot for you for your call and for sharing your thoughts. And Bob, I think for a lot of people, we hear most likely from people on the opposite ends of the debate, and I suspect, and correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of people are going to have somewhere in the middle type views. Stephen has guns, believes people should be allowed to have guns, wants to see gun control in some ways, recognizes it's tough to do.
Well, I think Stephen makes two really good points, to be honest. The first is he says that it's a hard issue, and that's absolutely right. I mean, that's why somebody like me can write a lot about this subject, because it's politically complicated, and that's absolutely true, especially these days, you know, in such a hyper-partisan atmosphere generally. And the other thing is that, and Stephen reflects kind of what I've found, because I talk to gun owners. I have a concealed carry permit myself here in New York State. And when you talk to gun owners, very typically what you hear is you introduce the term gun control and people kind of recoil from that. But then when you ask them, well, if you were in charge, you know, what laws would you like to see on the books? And what you often find is that gun owners realize that people who abuse guns hurt everybody who owns a gun. And that there are ways and there are policies to get at, you know, to sort of improve the situation. You're not going to eliminate violence or eliminate guns, obviously, but there are steps that can be taken. There are things that can be done. And gun owners often have some of the best ideas about what those steps should be.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science at State University of New York at Cortland. As he just mentioned, he's written a lot about guns and politics, 5 books on gun policy, including the new 8th edition of The Politics of Gun Control. He's talking to us some about President Joe Biden's recent moves aimed at addressing gun violence via executive action. Also, we want to hear from you about what formed your opinions about guns in your life and guns and the law. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up with firearms in your house, or are they kind of an alien substance in your life? Do you live in a community where guns are common and commonly carried for hunting or other purposes, or far from such a place? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about President Joe Biden, executive actions related to gun violence, and what leads people to think about guns and the law the way they do. Robert Spitzer is with us, Distinguished Service Professor of Political Science at the State University of New York at Cortland. He's written many books on gun policy. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on gun-related issues and how you got there. Tony is with us next in Milwaukee. Tony, hi.
Hi. Thank you very much for this conversation. Before my question, I could share a little bit about where I'm coming from. That sure. I am not pro gun. I'm for gun control. But I'm trying to, expand my viewpoints on kind of where people are coming from. I've noticed too, within my family, and, some friend groups that it's like, that people that they get kind of like more recently been really like driven to this gun, culture. So that was a concern for me. But to my question, you mentioned that there's, that the America is a safe place. I think you said that, and that, gun, crime or crimes are going down. But what's that relative to? What is, how can you put some context into that? If you look at us in a bubble, maybe the rates are going down. I don't have them in front of me, but how does that compare to all the other countries in the world? And like, I think that needs to be put into context because
I got you, Tony. I want to bring our guest in and get some more calls too. But I thanks for sharing your story and your question. His question first, Bob: how do we stack up the United States violence-wise, gun violence-wise in particular, with the rest of the world?
Well, with respect to crime and violent crime, the rates in other nations like European nations similar to us are quite similar. Overall crime rates fairly similar. Crime rates in European nations and Western democratic nations have been declining like they have been in the U.S. The one anomaly, the one difference is our murder rate is far, far higher than those nations. And that's because murder overwhelmingly involves firearms. No implement or weapon is more effective at hurting or killing a person than a gun. And that effect shows up in our statistics and why the American murder rate is so much higher per capita than in other nations, whereas our crime rates are really very comparable otherwise.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Eli now in La Crosse. Eli, hello. Hello. Excuse me. Hi, Eli.
Hi. I'm very pro-gun. I grew up around guns, always been interested in them, and I'm a young guy. I'm like 21, and as I've been growing older, I've consistently seen these harder and harder pushes to try to ban guns outright or ban certain types of guns, and it pushes a lot of us who would be okay with some of the things that gun control activists want to push back to not allow any to pass. Like, everything that Biden said in his executive orders, well, not everything, but a majority of it was not fact-based. There's a quote going around, he said, not all amendments are absolute, and if not all amendments are absolute, then our government stands on nothing. And just a lot of, I would say a lot of the minority of gun control activists, the very vocal minority, are pushing for policies that a lot of gun owners in America cannot agree with. And then even all the first-time gun owners in America, because gun ownership has gone up an insane amount over the last 18 months.
Eli, thanks a lot for the call. Lots to work with there, Bob. First of all, I'm interested in Eli's perspective that when one side hears the other side, in his case, as a gun owner hearing gun control measures be raised, hardening the lines, pushing people apart. What do you make of what he had to say there?
Well, it does. Partly people are hearing and responding to messaging over years and years and years that any new gun regulation or gun law is the first step to, you know, confiscation. But it's important to remember we have roughly 300 million guns in America, so they're not going away. Even a proposal like restricting assault weapons pretty much nibbles at the edge of that. I mean, there might be, 10 million, 12 million assault weapons in America, and even if every one of them disappeared, and nobody's saying that, that would still leave nearly 300 million guns anyway. So they're not going anywhere. And his point about constitutional amendments, despite the point he was making, every constitutional amendment has limits. There is no such thing as an absolute constitutional amendment. Even something like free speech or free press, people understand that there are limitations on free speech. Pornography, libel, slander, national security, commercial restrictions, any right you care to name has limitations. I think most people understand that that's the case. And as the Supreme Court made clear, it is possible to balance an individual right to have guns with existing gun laws. And the Supreme Court said as much back in 2008.
Thanks a lot for calling in, Eli. I appreciate it. I want to share an email from Bill. Bill says he believes in gun-owning rights, but not unfettered rights. And I'm going to quote from Bill's email. In my early 20s, there was a period when I was despondent and suicidal. I hatched a plan to travel west to take my own life, hoping the distance would somewhat reduce the trauma to my family here in Wisconsin. I got off a bus, Bill writes, in Colorado, went to a pawn shop and tried to buy a pistol. They couldn't sell me one because I wasn't a resident and would first have to establish that. Bill says that legal pause probably saved my life, and here I am writing to you 40 years later. Bill, thank you for sharing your story. I don't know, Bill's happy that law was there. I'm happy Bill's still here. Can we find places where people can agree on some measures, Bob, that are going to maybe save some lives?
Sure we can. And two key points there. One is that there are twice as many gun suicides every year as gun homicides. And that fact still isn't out there to the degree it should. That's why these red flag laws can be really important. And the other thing is that no implement is more effective at completing the suicide act than a gun. And there's all sorts of studies on that. And if you can intercede, if you can get a gun away from a person who might be suicidal, if a gun has a lock on it in a home, which it should, especially if you got a despondent teenager or, you know, somebody who's suicidal, those kinds of things can make a huge difference, and they're not that complicated.
Should throw out the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number. It's 800-273-8255. And Bob, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us again today.
Good to be with you.
Robert Spitzer is Distinguished Service Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at the State University of New York at Cortland. He's the author of 5 books on gun policy, including the new 8th edition of The Politics of Gun Control. He joined us for a look at new executive actions from the Biden administration related to gun violence. And we heard from you about how you developed some of your feelings related to guns and the law.